This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. Next month, a book by Michigan's most famous judge will be back in print more than four decades after it was first published. John Volker, who wrote under the pen name Robert Traver, says he left the Michigan Supreme Court in part to write Laughing Whitefish. It's the story of the daughter of a deceased Chippewa Indian who was cheated by a mining company in the 19th century. It's based on an important set of Michigan Supreme Court cases from the 1880s. In Volker's story, a young attorney recently arrived in Marquette, William Poe, is handed the complex case of Charlotte Cabogam. As he rises to call his first witness, Poe wonders whether the Indians, who had fared so poorly against the white invaders in the past, would now fare any better in their courts. Cabogam loses in the trial court, but is successful on appeal. Here to talk with me this morning about the book, the author, and the story behind it is Bill Castanier. He publishes mittenlit.com and writes for the Lansing City Pulse. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for your time today.
Oh, it's great. I wish it was warmer in Michigan. I just got back from New York City where it was in the 80s for 3 days. So.
Oh, my.
A little bit of decompression.
Yeah,
here.
ten degrees would be about right, huh?
Yeah, it's about right, yeah.
So you wrote recently a piece for Dome Magazine that says this story was in the back of John Volker's mind for many years, including the entire time he was on the bench of the Michigan Supreme Court. Tell us what you know about his fascination with the tale and then his eventual crafting of the novel.
Well, I have read and I've talked to people who have known him well, and he became interested in this case basically as a young lawyer. And he was told about the case in the Upper Peninsula where this Indian woman and her father had basically had their, what was due them, stolen from them. And he kind of kept this in the back of his mind as he was a practicing attorney. That was the story he wanted to always write. It wasn't necessarily Anatomy of a Murder. And then he wrote Danny and the Boys in 1951, which is basically a tale of some rough-hewn guys in the UP having a good time. And then he wrote Small Town DA, but then he wrote Anatomy of a Murder, and that became absolutely a blockbuster bestseller, New York Times for weeks upon weeks. It became a movie. All those things pushed Laughing Whitefish back. And he still, in the back of his mind, wanted to write that story because it was the one that most intrigued him. Certainly, growing up in the UP, as a young man, he knew a lot of Indians. He was close to them. He saw what had become of them because basically white men had taken their property, what was due them. So this was something that he felt passionately about.
Do you know, you report a comment he made that this was the toughest writing job he'd ever taken on. Do you know what he meant by tough?
Sure. He did this in 1970, this comment. He was speaking to the Michigan Historical Society, and he was speaking about the historical novel. And what he was referring to is a historical novel. First of all, you have to get it right. It's very difficult. You have to get it right about things that people know about. And in the Upper Peninsula, people knew about the history of the American Indian. They knew about the iron ore industry. They knew these things intimately. They had lived them, and they were only a generation or two away from them. So he said that to that he had to do incredible research to make this book happen. And I think that's what he was referring to. It was the most difficult style of writing he had ever done. Fiction, The Anatomy of a Murder, even though based on a real case, was not anywhere as difficult because this had to have historical accuracy.
And does that go even for the main character, William Poe, and the relationships he has with the people in the town, or is that more the fictional side?
That's the fictionalized aspect of it. And during this period of time, he was actually writing this book, and somewhat before that, There was a lot going on in this the literary sort of community of this country about historical fiction being sort of a bastard child. There was a lot of literary critics who were not happy with it because you're making some things up, obviously, to fit it through. And literary fiction historical fiction has been around a long time, but there was sort of a back push on this right about that time. So he was facing that too. But what you do, you know, you use the basic elements, and then you create a fiction around it because obviously no one heard the conversations. And for example, there, I believe there was 3 Supreme Court cases this was based on. He wove it into one. He had to take some literary fancy to make that happen, of course. And, you know, that is common among writers. It's certainly done today all the time.
And it seemed to me that he cast himself in the role of the young attorney, William Poe, who is sort of enamored with the law, but not sure he belongs in it, has a desire to write, is picking up the art of fly fishing. I mean, it just seemed like semi-autobiographical is not even the right term for that.
Oh, I think it is. I think it is. And I think that's not, that's not an uncommon thing for writers to do. It's one of the more easier things for them to do is put in some of their passions about what they do in life into their historical novel, and he really did that. I mean, you can see when you read this novel, you can see him in that book, no question about it.
And what did you think of the book, just as a read?
Now, here was my opinion, and it was like heresy, because the anniversary of Anatomy of Murder was just, I think, 3 years ago, the 50th anniversary, basically. And I during that time, I was telling people, I always liked Laughing Whitefish more. I mean, I liked Anatomy of a Murder. I mean, it was a genre-setting, you know, legal thriller. I mean, it basically almost helped create the legal thriller in the literary genre. But Laughing Whitefish, to me, felt like it had a home. It was a sense of place to me. It created the Upper Peninsula as, you know, my grandmother knew it. My grandmother was from the Upper Peninsula. And I think that's why I loved it. I liked the whole story of the Cornish community, the miner community, and it was, to me, it was pure Michigan. So that's, I loved it. And the writing, I think, is actually better. Like I say, that's heresy, but
right. Well, yeah. Talk about that. The book opens more or less with a scene in a bar, and all these Cornish miners come in, and it was actually sort of a difficult. The language is fairly hard to follow. Talk about that as the opening of the book, and what happens there, and how you see that playing into the rest of the story.
Well, I think in his 1970 address to the Historical Society of Michigan, Volker talked somewhat about that kind of initial scene. And he said to him, his father was a tavern owner. So as a young man or young boy, he was in the tavern quite a bit. And he overheard a lot of these conversations from miners who were just getting out of work. You know, he was probably just getting out of school at the time. And he went to help at the bar. And he heard these conversations, and he had a keen ear for remembering them. And that, although a lot of people think that Upers talk funny. This was the first generation of Cornish miners, or second generation probably he was referring to. And he had this ear that could pick up. I wish I could even read it to your audience, because it's an amazing dialect that we, you know, you just don't hear anymore. So he picked that up and he moved it in. But it's they're talking about, you know, real things. It's a barroom banter about why my food has got too much potatoes in it and not enough meat, and where's my boiler maker? But he uses in that Cornish tongue that I don't know anybody could replicate today. It's pretty much lost.
Do you have a copy of your book right there?
I don't, but I can read you I mean, could I try?
If you're willing, I could barely read it to myself.
Yeah. I mean, here's one, and it does make it hard. And I think, you know, that may have been one of the reasons that it didn't sell well initially. He did not try to, I guess, Americanize the language. John really, I believe, from what I've read, thought this was an incredibly good book. The Anatomy of a Murder was a massive seller, and this book had really limited sales. And maybe that's part of it. It's the language in it is a little put-offish. It's more commonly done today. I mean, there's a lot of vernacular used in writing. Okay, let me just try this.
Okay.
Ear, listen, tool. Jack spreading the salve, will you? He's happy as an old lady on payday, everything. Coming in, damn little given about it. Ah, here comes my lovely Boilermaker. You know, it's pretty hard to say what exactly that was.
Right.
And that's one of the easier ones. But he said he heard this language every day in his father's saloon when he was eavesdropping. And it's kind of like we'd be sitting today in a restaurant or a bar, and you hear people next to us talk, and you've got an ear for it. And I think that's one of the characteristics of a great author, is they can replicate that in writing. And if you've ever tried that, sitting in any place public and then go home and try to write exactly what someone said in a language that you're not quite sure of, it's hard. It's almost impossible for most people.
You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. That's Bill Castanier. He publishes mittenlit.com. He also writes for the Lansing City Pulse. We're talking about a new edition of the book Laughing Whitefish, coming out next month from Michigan State University Press. The book was written by John Voker under the pen name Robert Traver. Voker is most well known for his story Anatomy of a Murder, which was a smash hit and followed by a very popular movie starring Jimmy Stewart. But Laughing Whitefish, in some ways, was the book Voker was more fascinated with. He called it the toughest story he ever tackled. And you're listening to Points North. If you want to join in our conversation, if you have a comment or a question about John Voker or Laughing Whitefish, you could call us at 800-681-5929. We're joined now by Matthew Fletcher. He teaches Indigenous law at Michigan State University. He's a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and he wrote a new preface to the book for the edition that comes out next month. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Sure.
So Bill was just telling us that, talking about some of the standards for historical fiction and that you have to get it right. How right did Voker get this story compared to the true story it was based on of these people and the litigation that occurred in the late 19th century?
Well, I'd say he got it pretty right. The facts of the real case are something you probably couldn't even make up yourself. And I guess that he picked an outstanding fact pattern to write a novel about, because in terms of the way the case actually came down, and the way that actually worked out was something that law professors like to use for exams to try and torment their students. So, you know, the facts are great. You know, it's sort of this legend of a bunch of Indians taking iron or mining company surveyors out to show where the big copper, the big mining field is, where there's a huge vein that's going to make everybody rich. After in the middle of the Upper Peninsula, at a time when there were no roads out there, there's no railroads, there's no way to get out there. In fact, I think for 20 years or so, the mining company couldn't make any money off the thing because there was no way to get the ore out. So, you have this legendary story, and then one of the Indian scouts, or whatever you want to call them, the company promises them, I think in the original facts, it was just a handful of shares in the company. And after the company, of course, became ridiculously wealthy and successful, those shares became valuable. So only after a few more decades, after the original Indian scout is dead of natural causes or whatever, does his family come forth. And, you know, this is where I think the author, I think smartly for purposes of any kind of fiction, sort of streamlines the facts. It did go up to the Supreme Court 3 times. By the time it got there, the 3rd time, there were multiple plaintiffs, meaning he had kids from multiple partners, and they were all sort of joining in on the activity at the end. So he sort of streamlined it, made it just one woman, and for purposes of the fiction, it makes sense to do that. And as Volcker himself wrote, he didn't want to go down to Lansing 3 times in one novel, so one time was sufficient for him.
You know, Peter, one of the things, and Matt and I have talked, and I interviewed Matt for the story I did for Dome Magazine, But one of the things that I think that we sort of don't see is the side from the Indians contemporaneously. Most Indians that would read this today understand that he was writing about a history that was pretty common. I mean, this had some unique characteristics, but land being taken or promises given and not delivered, pretty much any Indian, and certainly in the Upper Peninsula, can identify with that. I remember growing up, and my grandmother grew up in Sault Ste. Marie. She was a Sault Ste. Marie band, or tribe, Chippewa, and when we were little, she always used to tell the story about when she was little, her family owned all the Sioux. And we didn't quite understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this book that's one of the reasons it's important to me. That tells the story of the American Indian.
Now, Matthew, the legal issues here are sort of complex. But you write in your introduction that the determination of the Michigan Supreme Court in the late 19th century did provide some foundational principles for tribal law today. Could you elaborate on what happened and how that affects legal matters today involving tribes?
Sure. Well, the legal principles, and again, Volcker, for purposes of writing the novel, had to streamline them. Were very complex. The first main principle was just establishing that there was a contract between Kabogam's family and Kabogam and the company, and that sounds kind of blah. I mean, he actually treats it a little bit because he needs to find a witness that witnessed the signing over of the shares, that sort of thing. Where it gets interesting are the company's defenses, because eventually they have to concede that, yes, there was the passing of these shares. And the company has two defenses. The first is, again, a little bit sort of blah, that he waited too long to bring a claim, that so much time had passed, and, you know, it just wasn't fair to the company to have to defend something they thought was extinct a long time ago. And that defense is called laches. And I want to talk about that in a little bit. Because I think that's very important too. But the third thing, which really is the key element of the case, of the decision in real life, and as well as sort of the strategy and the interest in the novel, is the defense of polygamy, which really is sort of what I call in my introduction a red herring. And the argument there is that Marja Gishik had multiple partners. Not at the same time necessarily, but he married a woman under state law, so he had a marriage certificate, and then they broke up. And then he married another woman. But the second time, he didn't get a divorce decree from the first marriage. And the second time, there was no state law-type marriage. It was arguably under Anishinaabe custom. So, and he had partners after that as well, as many as four or five. It's not entirely clear how many he had. And we think the plaintiff, in this case Charlotte Kabogam, came from that second or third marriages. Now, the company argues you can't enforce, that state courts should not be enforcing a contract for the benefit of a woman who is either the product of a polygamous marriage, which is what they argued, I think, to try to scandalize the thing, or really just in a more colloquial, non-politically correct way, she is a bastard child. And so in the 19th century, that didn't play over well. Now, what the Michigan Supreme Court did with that, and which was very interesting to me, is they said, it's none of our business how the Chippewas decide who is married and who is divorced. And, you know, I put in the introduction sort of the funny story about how it used to be that an Indian woman in Upper Peninsula in northern Michigan could divorce her man by putting his shoes out and his stuff out in the back porch. And when he came home from work and found all his stuff out there, he knew it was over. And so part of the story here is interesting is that the state courts, as entirely non-Indians, and a jury, they would have a jury of non-Indians, and they have an adversarial proceeding where only one theory can be proved right. It's sort of like Nero, thumbs up, thumbs down. That doesn't work out. It doesn't work so well in determining whether somebody is broken up under Chippewa customs. And so the Michigan Supreme Court just said, look, we're not going to question it. They come to us and say she's the perfectly valid candidate, and we can't second-guess that. We're not going to impose our state customs and traditions upon Chippewa customs and traditions. We're just not going to do that. And that was a fairly remarkable holding for the 19th century.
And what, where does that principle still exert influence today?
Well, in key forms, the ultimate meaning of it is that state law really has no import in Indian country. So if Indian tribes now, that there are 12 federally recognized tribes, that as a general rule, the states can't enforce their laws on Indian people and their internal domestic relations on the reservation. So, I mean, a lot of Indian people get married under state law now, but if a tribal government came up with a different way of getting married or a different way of deciding divorce, or even if potentially, although they won't do this, adopt a rule on polygamy or something like that, then state law would not be able to stop that. And in fact, the Michigan Supreme Court about 17 years ago now adopted a court rule, as well as I think all the tribal courts that have done the same thing, and reciprocity. What they have done is they've said, unless there is something really egregious about a tribal court order, we're going to give that deference. We'll enforce it in state courts. And tribal courts will do the same to state court orders. And I think that is ultimately a function of this Kabogam precedent. I mean, that kind of rule is helped along a great deal, a modern rule, by the Kabogam precedent, which is a recognition of tribal sovereignty and the ability of tribes to decide for themselves their own internal domestic relations.
Let me say, you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. That's Matthew Fletcher. He teaches Indigenous law at Michigan State University, is a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and has written a new preface to the book Laughing Whitefish. It was written by John Volker under the pen name Robert Traver in 1965. It was first published in 65, and it's going to be in print again and available next month from Michigan State University Press. I'm also talking with Bill Castanier. He publishes mittenlit.com, and he writes for the Lansing City Pulse. And if you want to talk about Laughing Whitefish, or John Volker, or any of the issues that we are discussing, you could join in our conversation this morning at 800-681-5929. Bill, I want to ask you, in thinking about the law or in thinking about the book and what Volker was aiming for and the value of the book, I got the sense that he was really shooting for a tale that was sort of an epic story about the law and the, you know, what the law is and what it offers to civilization. And at the beginning, the attorney is he's reflecting on the comments of the dean at his graduation from law school at the University of Michigan, and the speaker says something to the effect that the law is the alternative to a civilization basically ruled by jungle style violence. And I thought that kind of tied into Volker's how he paints the UP, and Marquette is sort of this shining city on the sea where all these attorneys are, and the attorneys themselves are even the alcoholic one is very noble, and you know they're sort of there to keep the peace. And I wonder what you think about all that and the place of the law in this book.
Well, I think you've hit the one of the really important themes of the book, and also one of the themes of Volker's life: the importance of law in a civilized society. He believed even if law took decades for justice, it was slow, it was patient, but the outcome was important even after all that time. And I think that's the book is almost a metaphor for that. He believed that it was his essence about the law. And I think you're right about the community, the courthouse in Marquette. He saw that. To him, it created an image, I think, in his life that is where justice was. And I think it was important for him to mix two cultures and you could find justice. He did an amazing thing in this book. And I think Matt, with the preface, puts it all in context. Without this preface, you really do have to know something about history of the Upper Peninsula and the history of the Indian Nation and the United States. And with this preface, this becomes a different book, a better book.
Although I got to say, he did a pretty good job spinning a tale out of arcane legal matters.
He did, and I think that may be one of his strong points.
And Matthew, what did you think? You've written a book yourself, not exactly in this mode, but in a similar style. What did you think of the story and the novel?
Well, you know, I read it probably for the first time less than 10 years ago, and you know what really struck me, how I think Bill said earlier how, you know, he was sort of ahead of his time when it comes to the legal aspects that I think are really interesting in this case, and there are multiple in the book. There are multiple things. I'm amazed at his ability to really hit the nail on the head. You know, I really enjoyed sort of the detective story, which is this isn't a murder mystery or who stole the Maltese Falcon, but it's a fantastic detective story about going back into time and talking to witnesses, many of whom are on their deathbed, to try and figure out what happened to these people decades before. And I was telling Bill in an interview with him earlier how, you know, it's perfect for telling law students, and I think even practicing lawyers and tribal leaders, what it's like to prepare a sort of a cold case for trial. And so many Indian claims are cold cases. They're resurrecting people who signed treaties or engaged in land transactions, you know, 50, 100, 150 years ago, and trying to give that a story. And how you put expert witnesses up, how you put eyewitnesses up on the stand and prepare them. And in this case, ironically for Willie Poe, he gets completely schooled at trial. After, you know, everything seems to go wrong. His witnesses start dying. He can't find witnesses that will corroborate his story about Chippewa custom. And then she shows up, I think it was a character named Cosimo, shows up at trial for the other side and totally destroys his case on Chippewa custom. So I thought that was just a fantastic element. And his ability to recognize an aspect of Indian claims overall that I think really bothers people who are non-Indians. And that aspect I mentioned before is what we call in the legal parlance, latches. And latches means you just waited too long. And just in the last 5 or 6 years, 7 years, has the United States Supreme Court really developed a theory of latches that is really cutting into Indian claims, Indian land claims, claims for tribal sovereignty, that they never really did before. And you know, Volcker presaged that. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, yeah, we took your land, and no, it wasn't fair, and no, you didn't compensate it for it, but it was so long ago, and it's not fair for you as Indians and Indian tribes to come back 50, 100, 150 years later and say you want compensation for the loss of your property rights or something like that. And you know, everybody's been saying that all along, and it was only in the last few years have the Supreme Court really jumped into that fray and said, yeah, we're starting to agree with that theory. You know, forget what the law says. We're just going to say it's not fair to everybody else in the world that Indians can try to bring these claims.
And I wonder what you thought about the court scenes, the cross-examination of witnesses. A number of the witnesses are indigenous people, and they're being asked about marriage customs and divorce and adoption and these sorts of things. And at one point, the plaintiff's attorney, William Poe, is realizing things are spinning out of control, and he sees that a good attorney can easily lead the witnesses with good questions, and that he senses that, at least in one case, the witness just sort of wants to tell the questioner what she thinks he wants to hear. Does that ring true to what you've seen of examination of witnesses in these sorts of matters?
Well, I mean, I'm no trial lawyer, and I wasn't a prosecutor for so many years like John Volcker was, but I will say that the trial scenes are fantastic. And I think they're fantastic because, and as I write in the preface that I put together, that I think what happens when you take unwritten and sort of vague tribal custom and put it in a thing where, in this adversarial system where you have lawyers and a judge trying to create a story out of that makes sense, that justifies somebody making or winning lots of money, winning a big judgment, or losing a big judgment. And, you know, I think it's a wonderful mix of how, a juxtaposition of how tribal custom just does not fit very well in that situation, in that kind of adversarial process. And it shows you how any witness is going to come down, especially if English is not their first language. And I mentioned Kazuma, I think that's who you were talking about. You know, she's a woman who helped to raise the plaintiff, the young woman in this case, when she was a kid. And she wants to help the girl to win her case, but she gets picked up first and prepped by the mining company first. And so they don't trick her, but they sort of lead her down the primrose path in sort of saying, yes, it was a polygamous marriage, and totally, wipes out Willie Poe's case in that way. Now, where I think Volker is just outstanding in putting this all together is how he wraps the whole thing up in the Supreme Court opinion when they go down to Lansing at the end, where the court sort of implicitly, and I think this is true in real life, acknowledges that you can't put Indian people on the stand in an adversarial process and make them come out with bright line rules that we like to see in, you know, Anglo-American law, come out with describing Chippewa custom in that way. It's just not going to work because, you know, my studies of tribal law and tradition dating back to the last couple hundred years, they were never intended to be put in a situation where it was an adversarial process. And moreover, they were intended to be sort of what we would call rules of equity, rules where things, the most fair circumstance would come to the fore, and people would come to this consensus that that's how it would be done. And you can't mix the two, the adversarial process and the more, I guess you could say, restorative justice type way that tribal people had always done it before. There's still a little bit of that left. A lot of the tribes in Michigan use what they call a peacemaker's process or a peacemaking system where they take, you know, first-time offenders or young juvenile offenders or small-type petty crimes and cases, and they take it out of the adversarial process where there has to be a winner and a loser, and they come out with a way to make things come back together in a way that's much more holistic and beneficial to everybody involved.
And Bill, people who like Anatomy of a Murder and find the courtroom scenes exciting in that, do you think they would find something similar in Laughing Whitefish?
Oh, absolutely. As Matt described, the scenes are perfect, and it's because Volker was obviously a keen district attorney, and he had listened, as an appeals judge, he had listened enough about these things to know how to write it. But also, you know, what really makes both books interesting is there is a sense of scandal in each. I mean, polygamous relationships was scandalous, still is. And in Anatomy of a Murder, there was an act of infidelity. So, I mean, there was scandal, and when he wrote about these things, it was still not commonly done. He was right at the cusp of that. So he knew, I think, intrinsically that scandal helped play well in writing a novel.
And why do you think that Laughing Whitefish was not a big seller and fell out of print after just a few years, I think?
That's a really good question. I think the year it came out, 65, I mean, you were starting to see a whole new kind of historical fiction. And I think this was about something that happened 100 years ago, approximately. And so it wasn't as exciting probably to that kind of reader. And I think you see that commonly in literature. They're like TV shows in some ways. There's favorites, and then they fall out, and they're not written anymore, or they're not read anymore, and then people go back and pick them up. But that's not uncommon, and he may have been right. Timing may have been way wrong for this. He may have been better to write it when he first wanted it written.
Did, other than Anatomy of a Murder, have which other books of John Volker's have remained continuously in print?
You know, Danny's Boys is in print, but that's in print because of Wayne State University. So again, you've got a university press taking the risk of putting that back in print. I think strangely, because this is, again, pure Michigan, His books on fishing are still some of the most popular books of his. And that whole mystique of John Volker fishing Frenchman's Pond, which was a secret place he fished, almost it's mystical almost and still is today. I mean, you've talked with people who fly fish, and if you talk with lawyers who fly fish, it's craziness. I mean, in a good way. I don't mean bad way. But, I mean, Trout Madness, which is a collection of short stories, still a wonderful book you can still get. Anatomy of a Fisherman, which he wrote in 64, still around. And I think it's Trout Magic. So those three books really kind of help complete him as an author. I mean, to write about fishing is a special thing in this country.
And he also, right after he left the Supreme Court, he wrote a book, I think, called Hornstein's Boys?
Right, Hornstein's Boys.
And have you read that?
I have not. And it is Hornstein's Boys, I think, is almost like a spy thriller.
Okay.
I may have read it, but I've read it a long time ago. And see, those, very few, except us talking about it, there's probably very few people that would know that he wrote Danny and the Boys, Small Town DA, which you see in paperback. And the paperback version usually has a lurid cover on it. It's real interesting.
I stumbled on a little on the Time magazine site, a short review of Hornstein's Boys, and the reviewer could not have been any less kind, and concluded that it would have been better if Volker had remained on the bench. That would have been a better service to society for him.
But I think most writers hate reviews. They're definitely afraid of what the New York Times Weekly Review is going to say about them. And you can, in some sense, live and die by those reviews. It's a pretty scary way to do it. It could be a great novel, but it doesn't matter if you get a bad review.
So, Matthew, we just have 3 or 4 minutes left here. But speaking of fishing, you point out in your preface that the year this came out, 1965, is an interesting year for the publication of a book like this, because the questions about tribal fishing rights were just starting to heat up in the mid-60s. Tell us a little bit about that and how the connection between these two things.
Sure. Well, John Volker, as a non-Indian who was a fisherman living in the Upper Peninsula, would have been one of the very few people in that demographic, I think, that would be supportive of any kind of tribal rights. 50, 60 years before Laughing Whitefish, the Michigan Supreme Court, in a case that would reverse almost immediately after Laughing Whitefish came out, had said there are no more treaty rights for Indians in the UP to hunt fish. And, that Indians at this time in the 60s were in a position where they had just spent, 10, 15 years trying to avoid termination from Congress. Their tribal governments were dead broke. They had almost really no prospects, and some of the poorest people in the United States were American Indians in Michigan. And so around the time of Laughing Whitefish is when some younger educated Indians who remembered that there were treaty rights, who remembered what those meant because their grandparents had been, basically subsistence hunters and fishers in the Upper Peninsula and northern lower Michigan, started doing that stuff again. And at Grand Traverse Band, which is my tribe, when we had treaty fishers start up, it really galvanized the tribe. They were sort of the heroes of the community, and they helped the tribal government become a legitimate thing. And I'm sure that's true in the Upper Peninsula as well. So, for somebody like Robert Traver, John Volker, to write a book like this, and it wasn't really about fishing, but it was about old tribal claims, Indian rights that remained in play, and to give sort of a good spin on that, a positive outlook at what Indian people are doing, was a bit revolutionary. And you asked earlier why Laughing Whitefish wasn't a big seller. There could be lots of reasons. One of which might be it was an unpopular book for non-Indians who were fishermen, because they didn't want to hear about Indians winning claims in court. That probably scared the hell out of them.
Right. And then was it the what's usually referred to as the Fox decision, which I think is Judge Fox was in Grand Rapids, and he determined that some tribes still had hunting and fishing rights under a treaty dated to 1836. Was that 69 or 79?
It was 79, but the case was filed in 1973. And there were other cases that were ongoing in Washington State and Oregon and Wisconsin and Minnesota around the same time. So people were aware that Indian people were bringing these claims again. And I think it was 71 or so, or 72, when the Michigan Supreme Court reversed itself and said, at least in the western Upper Peninsula, that treaty rights remained extant. And so when the Fox decision you're talking about was captioned United States versus Michigan, filed in 1973, that came at a time when there was a lot of that hostility towards Indian people. So, that decision wasn't until 79, but anybody could see the writing on the wall. What might happen in U.S. v. Michigan?
All right. Well, that is Matthew Fletcher. He teaches Indigenous law at Michigan State University, is a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. I've also been talking with Bill Castanier, who publishes mittenlit.com and writes for the Lansing City Pulse. And thank you both. It's been very enjoyable.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio.